Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market, by Nicholas Wapshot, narrated by Chris McDonnell. 1. The Land of Oz. Newsweek changes hands and the new editor, eager for controversy, pits Paul Samuelson against Milton Friedman. As stagflation bites, Keynesianism is put to the test. Vincent Astor, the reclusive head of the American branch of the New York real estate family, had been unwell since he caught a cold when staying at Cliveden, the country home of his British cousin, William Astor. The vast, gloomy house teemed with history. It was at lavish weekend parties there in the 1930s that William's parents, Waldorf and Nancy, had hosted the Cliveden set, the elite clique of senior government ministers, newspaper editors and aristocrats who in the 30s favoured appeasing Adolf Hitler. Vincent Astor, aged 66, was visiting his English cousins with his third wife, Brooke, 10 years his junior, and affectionately known by him as Pookie. She had caught up with her husband in London, after attending, on the arm of the Catholic Archbishop of New York, the coronation of Pope John XXIII in the Vatican. Their brief English sojourn over, Brooke and Vincent, still sniffling from his cold, boarded the SS United States, bound for Manhattan. The sea journey appears to have fired Vincent's imagination. He had inherited the Astor fortune at the age of 20 after his father, John Jacob Astor IV, drowned on the maiden voyage of the RMS Titanic. Popular tales of John Astor's sang-froid when the unsinkable liner began taking on water offered a flicker of grace under pressure in an otherwise bleak scene of disaster. Reports told of the tall, good-looking, phlegmatic multimillionaire escorting his pregnant wife Madeleine to a lifeboat before heading to the ship's kennels, where he liberated all the canine inmates, including his own Airedale terrier, Kitty. The suggestion that while awaiting his fate at the cocktail bar, Astor had quipped, "I ordered ice, but this is ridiculous," may not have been true. But the story fixed in the public imagination an image of Vincent's father as a collected character who embraced premature death without complaint. On Vincent's return from his English visit, he and Brooke made for the Astor family seat of Ferncliff, set on the Hudson River nearly 100 miles north of New York City. He sought out a screening in nearby Poughkeepsie of a new British movie, A Night to Remember, that retold the story of the Titanic sinking, to see how the filmmakers portrayed his father's understated heroism. He also wished to see how the freeing of Kitty was depicted. Echoes of his father's mortality were to stalk him through his life. While climbing the stairs to the theatre's balcony, Vincent suffered chest pains that were later diagnosed as the symptoms of a minor heart attack. Returning to Manhattan, Vincent's health worsened. On the night of February the 3rd, 1959, he and Brooke were due to attend a dinner party. Feeling unwell, Vincent urged his wife to go on her own. Returning home, she found him in bed, struggling to breathe. Brooke Astor called Vincent's personal physician, Connie Guion, who decided that his condition was stable and that there was no need to move him to the hospital. Around midnight, Vincent died, with the two women fretting at his bedside. This tragic turn had far-reaching consequences, not just for Brooke Astor, who lived another 5 eventful decades. Vincent's death was the first act in a string of incidents that would inadvertently construct a stage for one of the most significant and bitter duels in the history of economic thought. Vincent Astor left the vast bulk of his $134 million fortune, $1.2 billion in 2020 dollars, to Brooke, the first $2 million without strings. Half of what remained was invested to provide her with a vast income, the other half tied up in the Vincent Astor Foundation, established in 1948 to alleviate human misery. The foundation was to be wholly administered by Brooke, and the income distributed according to her wishes. She took her work for the foundation seriously and relished her task playing Lady Bountiful. "Money is like manure," she liked to say. "It should be spread around." Among the many notable properties the Astor Foundation owned were the landmark St. Regis Hotel on Fifth Avenue, Manhattan, and Newsweek magazine. After taking advice, the widow Astor decided she had little interest in becoming either a grand hotelier or a press magnate, and both the St. Regis and Newsweek were put up for sale. The magazine had been set up in 1933 by former employees of Henry Luce's conservative Time magazine as a more liberal alternative. By the late 50s, however, it had lost its zing. As Ben Bradley, Newsweek's Washington bureau chief at the time, recalled, it had become a staid business weekly, run by Malcolm Muir Sr. and Jr., father and son, and editor-in-chief and executive editor, respectively, as an adjunct of the Chamber of Commerce for their business friends, and was produced without energy or idealism. It had none of the brilliance or zest of Time, and none of the excesses of Henry Luce, the journalist David Halberstam wrote. When Brooke Astor decided to sell the magazine, the Muirs believed that as trusted friends of Vincent, they would be given first option to buy, and they began raising money. Norton Simon, chairman and CEO of the canned tomato and fruit company Hunt Foods, was also rumoured to be interested in the acquisition. Bradley, however, had other plans. He and Osborne Elliott, Newsweek's managing editor, began exploring more palatable alternatives and found a likely buyer in Phil Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. The energetic and charismatic Graham, who was married to Catherine Meyer, the daughter of the Washington Post's proprietor, was always looking for distraction from the clinical depression that dogged him, and he responded to an initial approach from Bradley and Elliott with enthusiasm. "Why don't you come on over now?" he said. Since being handed the Post to run by his wife's father, Graham had been on the lookout for a property that he could transform and call his own. Newsweek appeared to fit the bill. It was a prominent news brand that would sit neatly alongside the Post to become a potent rival to the burgeoning Time. It would need flair, imagination, and hard work, which Graham felt he could provide. So a bid was prepared, and on March the 9th, 1961, amid a snowstorm that engulfed New York City, Phil and Kate Graham waited in their Manhattan apartment in the Carlyle Hotel for news from the Astor Foundation board. The larky Brooke Astor favoured the sale to Graham from the start and argued his case to the rest of the board. And so it was that for the sum of $15 million, $129 million in 2020 dollars, Newsweek changed hands. The editorial direction of the magazine changed at once. As Bradley explained, all of a sudden the magazine shed its Chamber of Commerce, pro-business, pro-Republican establishment cast and staked out new ground for itself. Younger, more creative, less cynically biased than Time, fairer, less preachy and more fun. Under its new editor-in-chief, Oz Elliott, Newsweek gradually changed to a more liberal and entertaining Newsweekly for a general readership. To distance itself from the right-leaning Time, Elliott set about replacing, in his words, the predictably conservative views of contributors to reflect the progressive attitudes of the 60s. Elliott hoped a broader approach to Newsweek's opinion columns would invite much-needed controversy, and therefore public attention, to the changed magazine, and he continued refreshing Newsweek's content after Graham died by suicide in August 1963. Having brought in the old warhorse Walter Lippmann, a giant of American journalism and a seasoned columnist, in October 1962, and Emmett Hughes, a former speechwriter to President Dwight Eisenhower who had turned on his old master, in early 1965, Elliott decided to replace the magazine's business columnist, Henry Hazlitt, who alternated with Yale's professor of economics, Henry Wallach, a former member of Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers. Hazlitt was an old-school conservative, opposed to the federal government manipulating the economy, which since the end of World War II and the adoption of the revolutionary ideas of the British economist John Maynard Keynes, both political parties had embraced to minimize unemployment. Elliott thought Hazlitt's views antediluvian and set about finding a distinguished economist who would reflect the Keynesian thinking of the administration of President Lyndon B. Johnson. The obvious candidate was John Kenneth Galbraith, the Canadian-born Harvard economics professor, who through a series of best-selling books such as The Affluent Society had become America's best-known left-leaning public intellectual and most celebrated economist. Galbraith's ambition to see his progressive ideas put into practice had led him to work for Democratic presidents Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, and John F. Kennedy. He was tall and slim, with a pronounced drawl and lofty manner that echoed his patrician views. Eliot was convinced that such a stellar figure would be a newsworthy catch and would give a clear sign that Newsweek was heading in a new direction. Not only was Galbraith well-connected in the worlds of politics and economics, he had been a close friend of the assassinated Kennedy and of the dead president's immediate social circle, which included Phil and Catherine Graham, whose boisterous parties at their Georgetown home had made it Camelot's most glamorous salon. Galbraith was not interested. Never one to underestimate his own worth, he saw himself as far more than a columnist for a news magazine, and was reluctant to become tied to a weekly deadline. Used to writing at book length, Galbraith told Eliot he simply could not confine himself to the 1,000 words or so that a Newsweek column would allow, but Galbraith's protestations disguised a more complex truth. When in 1961 President Kennedy invited Galbraith to find a head for his new Council of Economic Advisers, the mission proved to be a veiled rebuff to Galbraith, who expected the role to fall to him. Kennedy made clear he favoured the Professor of Economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Paul A. Samuelson, who had helped Kennedy understand the economic choices before him during the 1960 campaign. But Samuelson had little appetite to move with his young family from Boston to Washington, D.C., and he declined the invitation. Samuelson found the young president hesitant. "People had JFK all wrong," Samuelson recalled. "They thought of him as a dashing, deciding type. He was an extremely hesitant person who checked the ice in front of him all the time." Kennedy asked his top aide and speechwriter, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., to sound out whether Galbraith would still take the post, but by this time Galbraith was having second thoughts of his own. As Schlesinger recalled, the president-elect was far from distressed when Galbraith finally said no. Galbraith was anxious his impact on the Kennedy administration would be overwhelmed by other voices. As he put it, "I didn't wish to come every day to the same discussion of the same questions around the same oak table, mostly with the same people, not all of whom I wished to see." Having failed to persuade Galbraith to join his team, Kennedy nonetheless invited him to sketch out the main tenets of the new administration's economic policy, to be announced in his inaugural address in January 1961. Galbraith drew up a list of wider aims the new administration should embrace, including an extension of civil rights, an increase in spending on education and health, an attempt to tackle widespread poverty, a more ethical foreign policy that would eschew support for foreign dictators, and an increase in financial and technical aid to poorer nations. But when Kennedy delivered his first address to the nation as president, Galbraith discovered that the new president's innate caution had prevailed. Many of the economist's more radical suggestions were absent from the speech. The assassination of Kennedy less than 2 years later distanced Galbraith from the Democratic leadership as power shifted to Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Galbraith was not a Johnson man, and in the absence of an invitation to join the new administration, Galbraith decided to continue to write books and give lectures. Before long, Galbraith found himself at odds with Johnson over the war in South Vietnam. As Galbraith's biographer, Richard Parker, described it, Galbraith moved from being a senior administration insider to being a passionate government outsider and critic. The Newsweek column would have given Galbraith a perfect platform from which to oppose Johnson's adventurist policies, but it was not to be. Galbraith declined Eliot's offer, so Eliot turned to Samuelson. Like Galbraith, Samuelson was an economist who had become well known far beyond academia, having written in 1948 the definitive and vastly popular Keynesian economics textbook titled simply Economics. But Samuelson told Eliot he was not interested. "You have to realize that as a result of my textbook I'm well-to-do and don't need the money," he told Eliot. Eliot countered that while he was sure that the few extra thousands a year that Newsweek could pay would not change Samuelson's life, a Newsweek column would provide even more luster to Samuelson's reputation as the foremost theoretical economist in America. When Eliot pointed out that Newsweek's weekly readership was 14 million, Eliot recalled, Samuelson's ears pricked up and he said yes. It was agreed he would be paid $400 a column, or $3,450 in 2020 dollars. By the time the columns began, however, in September, the fee had risen to $750, or $5,800 in 2020 dollars, $98,600 per year for 17 columns. Samuelson was told he was in complete control of the content and could even write the column's headlines if he wished. Eliot's plan was to have a triumvirate of economists taking it in turns commenting on the news. As he recalled, "I had a liberal economist, Samuelson, a centrist, Wallich, and still a dull right-winger, Hazlitt." What Eliot felt Newsweek needed was a young conservative economist to replace the superannuated Hazlitt. He also toyed with the idea of just having two economics columnists, right and left, Samuelson and another, and sounded out Samuelson about writing every other week. Samuelson replied that he was too busy revising his economics textbook. Once every 3 weeks was agreed. Since publication of Keynes's Revolutionary General Theory in 1936, conservative economics had been in retreat, and so were conservative economists. By the mid-60s, the Keynesian revolution in economic management of the American economy that was credited with ending the Great Depression was still in the ascendant, and faculty by faculty, Keynesians had replaced conservative economists in almost all major American universities. Finding an articulate young economist who would counter Samuelson's viewpoint would not be easy. But there was one lively professor, based in the conservative economic redoubt of the University of Chicago, who caught Eliot's eye. Milton Friedman. To Eliot's despair, when he approached Friedman in the summer of 1966, he too said he was too busy to write for Newsweek. Eliot was disappointed, but he was unaware that Friedman's formidable wife, Rose, was arguing Newsweek's case. "Though agreeing that this was a worthwhile project, my husband was very reluctant to undertake the assignment," recalled Rose. "He thought he would have difficulty finding enough issues which he could discuss clearly in the space allotted to a column. He felt that it would take too much time and thus interfere with his research, which was, along with his teaching, his main task." Rose Friedman understood how a column in a prominent news magazine would lift Friedman's profile, and she suggested to her husband that truly great economists found time to spread the word. Usually, she told Friedman, research and dissemination of ideas were left to two different sorts of people, but not always. John Maynard Keynes, for example, did both, she told him. And like Keynes, Friedman harbored an ambition beyond mere theoretical economics. The task of explaining the relationship between political freedom, for example, and a free market economy, or the consequences of the spread of government into more and more areas of our lives, has not been performed very well. I felt that my husband's special abilities and knowledge put him in a particularly good position to do so. Friedman drew up a list of topics he might tackle and wrote a couple of sample columns to see if the length and tone that Newsweek demanded was within his reach. He sent the trial columns to his friend, the Chicago economist George Stigler, who agreed with Rose that Friedman would not run out of ideas, and so urged him to accept the Newsweek position. Still undecided, Friedman called his friend Samuelson, whom he had known from his Chicago undergraduate days. Friedman recalled that after a long conversation, Samuelson strongly urged me to agree. By encouraging Friedman to write for Newsweek, Samuelson was suggesting that of all conservative economists, Friedman was the most appropriate opponent. Snagging Samuelson and Friedman was a journalistic coup for Eliot, the deal even making news in the New York Times. And Eliot's innovative decision to field a strong team of disparate economists received an accolade the following year when he was awarded a G.M. Loeb Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism. The scene was set for the most articulate and persistent verbal contest between major economists since Friedrich Hayek first challenged John Maynard Keynes to a duel by Learned Journal in 1931. Neither Eliot nor Samuelson nor Friedman could have imagined that the series of alternating columns would continue for the next 18 years, a time in which the Keynesian intellectual hegemony would be fundamentally challenged. The long series of Samuelson and Friedman columns that over time amounted to a running debate about the current state and the future of economics remained unprecedented in their contribution to the way economics is popularly understood. The duel would not have lasted long had it not been for the generosity and civility of Samuelson and Friedman, who, though ideological enemies, were personal friends. Both offered very different approaches to thought and writing, which reflected on their very different viewpoints. Samuelson's literary style betrayed his personality. His were the contributions of an established, successful, confident leader in his field, whose responses to challenges were largely generous, if sometimes gently patronizing. By contrast, Friedman was something of a street fighter whose right jabs were designed to score points as much as to persuade his endlessly skeptical rival. Friedman's intention was political, to alter events as they were happening by reason and advocacy. Samuelson tended to the long and broad view, reluctant to engage too readily in every passing controversy. Friedman put the success of the Newsweek venture down to the personal affection and respect the two men had for each other. Though Paul and I have often differed sharply on issues of public policy, we have been good personal friends and have respected each other's competence and contribution to economics, Friedman wrote. Samuelson returned the compliment in a letter to Friedman. I hope it will be said of us that, though we disagreed on much, we understood wherein our logical and empirical differences were based, and that we were pretty good at preserving amiability, friendship, and respect throughout. 2. Born Again in a Chicago Classroom. From humble beginnings in Gary, Indiana, Samuelson's precocious ability at math leads him to be taught by the free market economists of the Chicago School. Paul Samuelson and Milton Friedman were similar in many ways. Both were born Jewish, both married fellow members of their university class, both achieved their first degrees from and shared graduate classes at the University of Chicago. And there were personal links too. At Chicago, Samuelson was taught economics by Aaron Director, Friedman's wife Rose's brother. Samuelson used to joke that Director was the only man alive who could later speak of my radical brother-in-law Milton Friedman. But despite similarities in their home backgrounds and their personal life experiences, from which their views and vantage points were largely derived, the two men were very different. Paul Anthony Samuelson was born on May 15, 1915, in Gary, Indiana, at the southernmost tip of Lake Michigan where, in his words, Appalachian coal brought by rail met Minnesota iron ore brought by ship, to be processed in Gary Works, the largest steel plant in the world. Samuelson's father, Frank, and his mother, Frank's first cousin, Ella Lipton, had migrated to the United States from that little part of Poland that's between Lithuania and East Prussia. Frank Samuelson was a pestle and mortar pharmacist whose customers were largely first-generation immigrant steelworkers from Poland, Czechoslovakia, Croatia, Russia, and other parts of Eastern Europe. Frank Samuelson spoke to his customers in Slavish, a pidgin language which combined the common words in his patients' many home tongues. Gary was a boom town, even before demand for steel for armaments and war materiel soared after the US entry into World War I, and Frank Samuelson would ride the economic prosperity of the 1920s. That led to considerable affluence, recalled Paul, the second of Frank and Ella Samuelson's three sons. I wasn't underprivileged, never knew a hungry day in my life. What is more, Gary's boom was linked to government activity. Growing up in Gary, he recalled, was a pretty good preparation to become, in later life, an economist. Not a businessman, but an economist, because I experienced the boom of wartime heavy spending. When he was 17 months old, Samuelson was sent to live with foster parents on a 100-acre farm in Porter County, near Gary. The move would puzzle him for the rest of his life, though he suspected his parents may have wanted him to escape Gary's poor air quality. The farmers he was billeted with, Uncle Sam and Aunt Frieda, neither of them blood relatives, raised Samuelson as their own until he was 5 or 6 years old. This whole adventure cost $1 a day for food, lodging, and love from someone who was not my DNA, he said. Asked in old age why he thought his parents had abandoned him at such a tender age, Samuelson could only speculate.
I think maybe my mother was a premature feminist who didn't relish primarily cooking and so forth. Maybe I was a difficult eater, but at 17 months, how can you tell? He appears to have borne his parents no grudge, nor does being raised by Sam and Frieda appear to have left any lasting psychological scars. Instead, Samuelson seems to have learned from his brief experience as an orphan. Life on the farm was primitive. I know what it was like to have no indoor electricity, no indoor central heat, and of course no indoor plumbing. It meant the privy and the chamber pot, he recalled. Going shopping in Valparaiso, which was only 5 miles away, involved harnessing the horse to the buggy and killed most of the morning. Samuelson was a highly intelligent boy, who, despite the lack of obvious intellectual stimulation in the farmyard, soon began to devour books from the library. He went to the local taxpayer-funded school, which had high standards, and he proved to be smart enough to skip grades. Samuelson went on to attend about 8 schools in all, including in Florida, where his parents also briefly lived. In 1923, the Samuelsons took Paul back into the family and returned to Chicago, where he studied at Hyde Park High School. He began to display an early interest in the way the economy worked. With the market in stocks booming through the 20s and sucking in ordinary Americans looking to make a buck, he started following the stock market and helped his high school algebra teacher pick winners from the stock report in the newspaper. Alas, there is no record of whether Samuelson's stock picks turned a profit. At age 16, displaying a precocious ability in mathematics, Samuelson was allowed early admission to the University of Chicago and discovered there, in his first lecture on his first day, the subject that would fascinate him for the rest of his life. He liked to say, "I was born on January the 2nd, 1932, when I walked into the first University of Chicago classroom." Economics was a perfect match for his intellect. He never considered another subject or another career. What incredible luck, while still adolescent, to stumble onto the subject that was of perfect interest to me, and for which I had special aptitudes, he recalled. Among the first ideas he learned about in his early days at Chicago were British economist Robert Malthus's theory about how people will always produce so many children that by the law of diminishing returns, the population will always grow, so that wages are held down to a minimum. I found that very interesting, but found it very simple, and I thought there must be some complications that I didn't understand, he recalled. Samuelson's first teacher in economics was Aaron Director, whom Samuelson found very conservative, very iconoclastic, but very interesting to me. Samuelson concentrated his studies on economics and was taught by giants of the Chicago school, such as Frank Knight, Jacob Viner, Henry Simons, and Paul Douglas. Samuelson was, by all accounts, a pleasure to teach. Viner described...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?